Welcome to our summer series about kingdom living at the Scenic Hills Church of Christ in Pensacola, Florida. The sixth lesson from the Sermon on the Mount is by Kyle Rye, and his message is about to swear or not to swear. Turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5, verses 33 through 37. And now, Brother Rye.
So thus far in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has addressed several topics. And if you've noticed, he's using kind of a pattern. You've heard that it was said, but I tell you. So you have heard that it was said, you know, do not murder, but I tell you, do not be angry with your brother. You've heard that it was said, do not commit adultery, but I tell you, do not lust. You have heard that it was said, you have to write a certificate of divorce, but I tell you, don't divorce. That's the Kyle Rye version of those parts of the Sermon on the Mount. And so we've had this pattern emerge here in the past few sections where Jesus will tell you what the Mosaic Law said and then draw a comparison to what the heart of the issue was. So, for instance, when Jesus addressed what the law said about murder, he drew a comparison with anger and established an expectation of reconciling with one another. And then he addressed what the law said about adultery and drew a comparison with lust and then established an expectation of purity. And then he addressed what the law said about divorce and drew a comparison with adultery and then established an expectation of commitment. And now all of a sudden he transitions into the subject of oaths. We've dealt with murder, we've dealt with adultery, and we dealt with divorce, and now oaths? It seems so out of place when you first think about it, when you first notice it. Like, we're talking about three things prior to this that we equate to moderate to big level sins, and now we're talking about taking oaths and swearing? This seems so minor and so insignificant to the issues of murder or anger, the lust and adultery, divorce. This seems minor, and yet Jesus takes the time in his most well-known sermon to address it. So there's got to be a reason for it. So let's start. Matthew chapter 5, verse 33. Let me just read this one section from here to verse 37 real quick, and then we'll start talking about it. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. Wow. So, that's pretty intense when you think about what Jesus is saying. Don't swear. How many of you are like me? You grew up being told, never say I swear. How many of you were taught that growing up? You can say I promise all day long, but don't say I swear. And I remember as a kid, I was like, what does it matter? The word swear is not a bad word. The word swear and promise, they mean the same thing, don't they? So what's the difference between me using one phrase and the other? It was inconsistent to me. And I remember thinking, okay, is this an issue of the sentiment being expressed? Or is this an issue of the word? If it's an issue of the sentiment, then we don't need to say I promise or I vow. If it's an issue of sentiment, we need to eliminate all those. If it's an issue of the word, then explain to me what's wrong with the word swear. And on top of that, I remember thinking, then why do we do it if we're appearing before the court? You know, why do we take vows when we're getting married? There was so much inconsistency for me in the explanation of this, the application of this, and what we did in everyday life. So I struggled with this passage. I'd brush over it for a long time in my life. I would ignore it. It wasn't a worthwhile part of the Sermon on the Mount because it didn't make sense and we didn't know how to apply it. So I want to help us tonight. Hopefully get to an understanding of the intent of what Jesus is trying to epitomize here in these instructions. But we have to begin by looking at what Mosaic Law said. Now, on the previous three subjects, it was pretty simple to find what Jesus was referencing. For instance, with the do not murder, what was Jesus referencing from the Old Testament? Ten Commandments. On committing adultery, what was he referencing? Ten Commandments. I mean, that's easy. Oaths, not so much. Probably appears in passages you haven't spent much time looking at before. But Jesus is actually combining the thoughts of two different passages. The first one is from Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 12. And if you look at Leviticus 19 and verse 12, oh, well, let me back up. I didn't make this statement. When you look at Matthew chapter 5 and verse 33, Jesus is summarizing the teaching of Mosaic law in regards to swearing or taking oaths. So he says, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. He is quoting the Old Testament in that statement, but doing so by meshing two passages together. Jesus did that from time to time. And it wasn't that he was misquoting Scripture. He's just utilizing two different passages to fulfill the thought process. So he's quoting Mosaic law as it pertains to the taking of oaths or swearing. I'll use those phrases interchangeably tonight. And he's referencing, number one, he's referencing Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 12, which says, you shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. How would swearing by the Lord's name profane his name? Okay. What we're talking about is a situation where you're claiming something as a truthful statement and appealing to God as your witness that it is. Paul will use that kind of language in the epistles. We'll look at that in a minute. And you're appealing to God for the truthfulness of what you're saying, but you're not being truthful. You're not being truthful, and you're claiming that God is a witness to your truthfulness, but you're profaning his name by calling upon it as evidence of truth when it's not. So there is, that's partly how we have this issue of profaning his name. Now, this concept of profaning his name, there is some connection to the Ten Commandments with that. We know, what's the third commandment? It has something to do with God. In vain. We're dealing with some sentiment here that is similar, not the same, in the misuse of the Lord's name is what I'm talking about. Using his name in vain, profaning his name, aren't exactly the same thing, but they're both a misuse of his name. And we don't really understand the power of God's name today as much as they did in Judaism, in the Old Testament. The name meant something probably more so than it does today. Because when you injected God's name into something, that was a monotheistic claim. When you brought Yahweh into it, or whatever title you used for him, you're associating yourself with a single God, while the rest of the world had their many gods. And so his name was sacred. His name was important. So we have this issue here of misusing his name. The other passage it's referencing is Numbers chapter 30 and verse 2, where it says, if a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. What's that passage essentially saying? Boil it down into modern day English. What does it say? Keep your promise. Keep your word. Whatever you say you're going to do, do it. Well, we understand that principle in Christianity. We understand that expectation. That's not, but there was a Mosaic law that prescribed that. We'll get to how they abuse these two things in just a moment. But for right now, you need to see what he was referencing. He's referencing the expectation that, one, you will keep your word. And two, you will not swear, you will not take an oath, you will not make a vow based on God that you know you aren't going to keep. So that's what he's referencing. Now here's what we need to understand. When we look at Matthew chapter 5 in this passage, Jesus says, do not take an oath at all. That seems really clear. Don't take an oath. How many of you have been sworn in the court system somewhere, somehow? Okay, so y'all have all sinned? Okay, how many of you took a vow of marriage? Raise your hand. Man, we got a whole bunch of sinners tonight. We're going to have a lot of people come forward. You see, we understand that he said, do not take an oath. That registers with us. But how well do we apply it? If that's really what he meant. See, the issue is, what did he mean? So let's talk about that. First and foremost, when we look at this passage, we need to realize that oaths in and of themselves are not sinful. Oaths in and of themselves are not sinful. And the Old Testament backs this up. See, even under Mosaic law, there are a couple of situations in which oaths were prescribed. If you go to Exodus chapter 22, an oath is being used in a stewardship situation there. It talks about an individual entrusting a neighbor to take care of one of his livestock. And in the event that something bad happens to that animal, unbeknownst to the one taking care of his neighbor's livestock, then an oath is used to determine whether or not he is liable. So you're taking care of somebody's animal. The animal wanders off and dies by being attacked by a wild animal. You knew nothing about it. You would take an oath to indicate that you did not intentionally kill that animal or steal and hide it so it can become yours. It was a liability oath. Then there's a situation in Numbers chapter 5, which is kind of strange. In Numbers chapter 5, instructions are given about how to handle a case of presumed adultery. In such a situation, the spouse, which in the context of Numbers chapter 5, it's a woman. The man never committed adultery in the Old Testament, apparently. But the woman, who is believed to have broken her oath to both God and her husband, would have to take an oath of the curse, it's called, to prove her innocence or guilt. And there's this process of determining innocence or guilt based on this oath and the things that associated with it. I don't want to go into details on that. But there is this oath that is taken to indicate your innocence in this presumed adulterous situation. So there's two examples under Mosaic law which indicates that not all oaths are condemned in the Old Testament, that there are some that are prescribed in these two situations. More than that, in the New Testament, oaths are mentioned and used even after Jesus discussed this in Matthew chapter 5. Jesus was put under oath on one occasion. In Matthew chapter 26, he's put on oath by the high priest during one of his trials. Here's the thing. Jesus responded when put under oath. If you look at that passage, Matthew chapter 26 and verse 63, Jesus remained silent, and the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." That phrase, that terminology of adjuring to God is a statement, is an oath issue, is a challenge to take a vow. And Jesus said to him, "You have said so, but I tell you from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." All my point is Jesus responded when put under oath. Here's the thing. If oaths were sinful, Jesus would have had a perfect opportunity to critique the high priest's use of one in this particular instance. Not only that, if oaths were sinful, then Jesus could not be identified as sinless because he responded under oath. So we have Jesus here, the sinless one, demonstrating that oaths in and of themselves are not sinful. Then you have the Apostle Paul. He used oaths in many of his writings. His typical format when he would use an oath, he would call on God as his witness that what he's saying is truthful. So you have Romans chapter 1 verse 9 where he says, "For God is my witness." Same sentiment is stated in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 23 and Philippians chapter 1 verse 8. In Galatians chapter 1 verse 20, there's this parenthetical statement he makes. He says, "In what I am writing to you before God, I do not lie." He's using oath language there to say, "God is my witness that I'm not lying." What's really fascinating is 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 27, where he puts his readers under an oath. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 27, he says, "I put you under oath before the Lord to have this letter read to all the brothers." Paul used oaths. Now, I started thinking, why would Paul need to use an oath to say, "As God is my witness on this matter, I'm telling you the truth"? Why would that be necessary for Paul, this great apostle, this individual that we can be sometimes fascinated by his passion and fascinated by his zeal, fascinated by his writings, and yet he feels the need to call on God as a witness for himself? Why do you think that is? Why? There you go. Paul is able to claim apostleship, but not the same as the others. So is he really inspired the way the other 11 guys are? Or 12 once Matthias became one? Not only that, what was Paul doing before he became a Christian? I mean, even when he was converted, the leaders of Christianity didn't want to accept him in because they thought it was a ruse. They thought he was trying to infiltrate and capture. So Paul had some credibility issues during a good bit of his career simply because he had a history. Not only that, everywhere he went, he started in the synagogues, working with the Jews first, taking the gospel to them first. Everywhere he went, that was his strategy. And everywhere he went, he came in conflict with the Jews. And everywhere he went, it seemed like they would cast him out. Not every case. I mean, some cases they just stoned him to death. But they had conflict with him regularly. And so now you're riding to these places where you got kicked out of the synagogue, and it probably left some people wondering, who do I listen to? Do I listen to the leader of the synagogue, or do I listen to Paul? He was really intriguing. He had some very good points. And Paul's trying to support his credibility on the subjects he's writing about. So there was some necessity there for Paul to do that to some degree. But what's really fascinating is Hebrews chapter 6, because here the author of Hebrews indicates that God took an oath. How does God take an oath? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but listen to this passage. For when God made a promise to Abraham, okay, we understand that terminology. God made a promise to Abraham. Since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise for the people. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. If oaths are sinful, then God can't be using one. So oaths in and of themselves aren't sinful. It is not wrong to take an oath. That's what we need to understand, that even though Jesus said, do not take an oath, it's not because they're sinful in and of themselves. Jesus is addressing some other issues, in particularly dishonesty. See, swearing is often the necessary result of a failure to be trustworthy. I mean, think about that. The only time you have to promise you're telling the truth or swear you're telling the truth or take an oath is because somewhere along the way, you or someone else has demonstrated dishonesty so that there's a worry about credibility. So we have this. So we need to understand that the purpose of swearing or taking oaths is to affirm the truth of a statement and to call upon God to judge the truthfulness upon it. So we vow and we swear and we promise, or we take an oath because we're trying to prove that what we are saying is truthful. The fact that we need to prove that something we are saying is truthful is an indication that we have been untruthful at some point in the past. You see, I grew up in the generation where you just say, just kidding, and everything's fine. As long as you finish it with just kidding, there's nothing wrong with what you said. I mean, that was the mentality you had. But the problem with that is it creates credibility issues. We've all heard the story, the boy who cried wolf. That story demonstrates that even at a young age, we have this tendency to not be completely honest, and we have to be taught that truthfulness is a necessity. So an oath is needed only if a person's word alone is unreliable. Let me give you an example of this. Open up to Genesis chapter 20 and 21. We're actually going to start in chapter 21. And we're going to read about some interactions between Abraham and a guy named Abimelech. If you go to Genesis chapter 21, Abraham is living in Abimelech's territory. And I want you to look at what happened in verses 22 through 24. Genesis chapter 21, beginning verse 22. At that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, said to Abraham, God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my descendants or with my posterity, but as I have dealt kindly with you, so you will deal with me and with the land where you have sojourned. And Abraham said, I swear. So Abimelech makes Abraham swear to be kind, to keep his word. Why would Abimelech need to do that? You just turn back to chapter 20 and look at the first two verses. And you'll be reminded of a story in the life of Abraham. Genesis chapter 20, this is the first interaction between Abraham and Abimelech. From there, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Oh, that's why Abimelech couldn't really trust Abraham. Because Abraham had lied before. You see, Abimelech asked Abraham to swear that he wouldn't deal falsely with him because Abraham was previously untruthful about his relationship with Sarah. Abraham had demonstrated a lack of credibility, and now his word cannot be completely trusted. And this wasn't the first time Abraham had done it. He'd done that with Pharaoh in Egypt. We don't really, and his son's going to do the same strategy. There is an issue of honesty. So what we need to realize about oath taking is that most of the time we take oaths because we've created a situation in which we are not as reliable with our words as we should be. Sometimes it's the result of culture. I mean, when you enter a court and you have to take an oath before you appear as a witness, it's not because you've been untruthful to the court, but because people have been untruthful in court. And there needed to be a way to protect the truth in that situation. So if you go in there and you are dishonest and it's proven that you're dishonest, what happens? You're held in contempt. So there, it's a process because of a lack of credibility and a lack of truthfulness in our culture that now affects us in that situation. But a lack of, so what is happening here, Jesus isn't saying that it's wrong to take an oath, but he is saying it's better to never need them. What Jesus' point is be honest all the time so that you never have to take an oath. So that all you have to do is say yes or no, and that's believed because you're a person who is credible. You're a person who is honest. He's challenging the cultural acceptance of dishonesty here. James chapter 5 and verse 12 reiterates Jesus' point. It says, "But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation." It's a call to honesty. It's a call to credibility that if we're going to be followers of Christ, we have to be people who don't lie, who is never questioned whether or not we tell the truth. Because think about it. What impact does a lack of honesty have on our credibility as a Christian? If I'm not deemed honest or credible, then why would anybody want to listen to me about their salvation? How do they know I'm telling them the truth? How do they know I'm being honest with them? Credibility matters when it comes to those who follow Christ. And so Jesus' real issue here isn't with oaths themselves, but with the fact that they are needed because there's a lack of credibility. So Jesus isn't saying that it's wrong to take an oath. He's saying it's better to never need them. He's challenging his disciples to be people who don't have to take oaths because dishonesty is the problem. Now, that's not the only problem when it comes to swearing or taking oaths, because Jesus is going to address another issue. Because what's happening, the context of the oaths that are being taken, that are actually described here, you know, swearing by heaven and earth or swearing by the temple and things like that, they are an issue of hypocrisy. Because the Jewish practice of swearing was very hypocritical. And I want to show you what I mean by this. The Jewish rabbis taught that one was exempt from an oath if he swore by heaven or earth, but if he swore by any of the divine names or by some other divine attribute, then he was bound to the oath. Now, that information comes not from the Bible, but from the Mishnah. You may not be familiar with the Mishnah. It was kind of like a commentary on Mosaic law. It contained the legal interpretations of Mosaic law that were passed down orally over the years between rabbis, and they were finally compiled into a written form known as the Mishnah, way back in 217 A.D. And Jews consider the oral traditions, the oral interpretations that have been passed down, they consider them as authoritative as the original scriptures itself. And so if you talk to a Jewish person, they may not just quote Mosaic law to you, they may quote the Mishnah to you, the commentary on Mosaic law. And the commentary on Mosaic law has said that, okay, here's the deal. If you swear by heaven and earth, you don't have to keep your oath. But if you swear by God's name, any of God's names, any of God's titles, or any of God's attributes, then you got to keep it. That seems weird. So if you swear by Adonai, which means Lord, if you swear by Yahweh, the name of God, if you swear by El Shaddai, which means God Almighty, then you got to keep that oath. If you swear by he who is merciful and gracious, which is a quote of a title of God, you got to keep that oath. But as long as I say heaven or earth, I can get out of it. You know what that is? That's the grown-up, sophisticated version of making a promise with your fingers crossed. That's what they're doing. But is that what Mosaic Law said? We looked at a passage from Leviticus to Numbers, but I want you to look at a couple of other passages from the Old Testament. Because Mosaic Law instructed the Israelites to take oaths only in the name of God. You see, Mosaic Law didn't forbid oath-taking. It just put limitations and parameters around it. So if you go to Deuteronomy chapter 6, you're going to see an instruction that is very specific to the type of oath you can take. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 13. It is the Lord your God you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the people who are around you. See, the issue in this passage is that you need to, your allegiance needs to be to God. The instruction to only make an oath in God's name is immediately followed by an instruction to not pursue other gods. So it appears that the reason one should not take an oath in the name of another deity is because to do so is tantamount to worshiping and or serving another deity. And let's be honest, sometimes we worship or serve things that are man-made. So to even take an oath, say, by the temple, which is a human construction, is declaring an allegiance to something that isn't God. You see, anything that you're going to swear by, you're swearing by something that's greater than yourself. You're choosing to swear by something, as Hebrews chapter 6 told us, when you swear by something, you're swearing by something greater than you. You're declaring something as important, as powerful. Nothing deserves that attention and that recognition but God. And so that's part of the issue. If you go to Deuteronomy chapter 10, the same instruction is kind of repeated there. Verse 20 and 21 says, you shall fear the Lord your God, you shall serve him and hold fast to him, and by his name you shall swear. He is your praise, he is your God who has done for you these great and terrifying things that your eyes have seen. So this passage reinforces the idea that God is the only one in whose name oaths were to be taken because oaths indicated allegiance. So Mosaic Law says, okay, the only way you can take an oath is if you're swearing by the name of God, by God's identity, because that's indicating that he's the greater than, that he's the one who can hold you accountable and no one else. The second thing Mosaic Law prohibited here, not only did it say that you can only take oaths in the name of God, but it prohibited the Israelites from not fulfilling their oaths. So Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 21 through 23 addresses this, particularly addresses expectations in conjunction with oaths. So it says, if you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it. There's urgency in that language. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. Oh, it's not that taking an oath is sinful, it's the failure of me to fulfill it that is sin. Verse 22, but if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. Okay, if I don't think I can do it, I best not say it. That's what that said. And then verse 23, you shall be careful to do what has passed your lips, for you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. That's an expectation of honesty. The passage indicates that you don't have to take an oath or vow for any particular reason. They're not mandatory that you take oaths. But if you do make an oath or a vow, then you're expected to fulfill it in a timely fashion. Did you notice that? Not delay fulfilling it. So the Israelites, under Mosaic Law, are allowed to make oaths with two parameters. You can only do it in the name of God, and you can't make a false oath, meaning don't make an oath that you intend to not keep. You're expected to keep your word. So when Jesus addressed the issue of oaths, he wasn't condemning their use, but instead he was addressing the purpose of Mosaic Law's limitations and expectations of oaths. The purpose was to ensure honesty. So when you look at what Mosaic Law actually said, and you compare it to what the rabbis were teaching, there's some incongruity. You see, the Mosaic Law says, only take oaths in the name of God. Be sure you fulfill your oaths. But the rabbis were saying, well, as long as you don't interject God's name in the oath, then you don't have to keep it. Now, it is true that they are appealing. Let me rephrase that. They are appealing to the fact that if you use God's name in the oath, you got to keep it. They're appealing to that, but they're ignoring the fact that Scripture says, don't make an oath you're not going to keep. So here's what the practice was of first century rabbis. What they were doing is they would make oaths so that they would look righteous and they would look pious and they would look important and super religious. They would make this grand oath and then they would swear by heaven or earth or the temple or the altar or the gold or something. They would swear by something, but not God. Because what they wanted to do is say something that made them look good with the intent of never doing it because it was too extreme. So maybe they would stand up there at the temple. You remember the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, how his prayer was intended for everybody to hear? Maybe they would stand up there and go, okay, God, I vow today by heaven and earth that I will give you everything I own, never having the intent to do it. And in their mind, they're standing there with their fingers crossed because they used heaven and earth instead of God's name, and so they don't have to do it anymore. And Jesus condemns that as hypocrisy. So go with me to Matthew chapter 23. Matthew chapter 23, Jesus addresses this subject much like he did in Matthew chapter 5. In Matthew chapter 23, drop down to verse 16. Woe to you, blind guides, who say if anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? So whoever swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. Whoever swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. The religious leaders, these rabbis, these chief priests, and all these characters have come to the conclusion that if they change the terminology of what they're swearing by, then they can get away with not doing it. This whole chapter of Matthew chapter 23, it has seven woes. If you read through it, there's seven times that Jesus says woe to these scribes and Pharisees. And what he's doing is saying, you guys are hypocrites. Because you want people to think you're righteous, but everything you're doing behind the scenes is completely unrighteous. You're intentionally making a vow that you know you're not going to keep just because you want people to think you're super religious. And so, Jesus points out, he makes it clear both in chapter 23 and if you go back to chapter 5, that it doesn't matter what kind of terminology you try to insert with your oath, you're obligated to keep it. So if you go back to chapter 5 and you think about what we just read in chapter 23, in chapter 5 he says, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great God. You know what Jesus is saying? Jesus's reasoning is that while the Jews were not always swearing in God's name, they were swearing by things that were intimately connected to God. So if you swear by heaven, then you're swearing by God's throne. If you swear by earth, then you're swearing by God's footstool. If you're swearing by Jerusalem, then you're swearing by God's city. And if you're swearing by the temple, you're swearing by God's dwelling. They may not be using God's name, but they're using things that are intimately connected to God. So it doesn't matter if God's name is interjected or not. They're expected to keep their vows. Because no matter what you swear by, you're supposed to keep it. And essentially, by breaking their oaths intentionally, they were profaning the name of God. So what Jesus is getting at here in Matthew chapter 5, when he says, do not swear at all, but let your yes be yes, your no be no, he was pointing to Mosaic Law's intent to promote honesty, to eliminate hypocrisy. Jesus isn't calling oaths a sin. He was instructing his followers to eliminate oaths because they were associated with dishonesty and hypocrisy. And that his followers should be so credible that they never need to make an oath. That's essentially what Jesus is trying to get to. And in this passage, and not only criticizing the use of oaths because of the hypocrisy that's associated with them and the dishonesty that's associated with them, he's also establishing an expectation of integrity. He's establishing this expectation that his people will be people of integrity. Integrity is the state of being whole, of being entire, being the same through and through. Integrity means that what you see on the outside is exactly the same as what you see on the inside. The problem with the religious leaders, the scribes and the Pharisees and such, is that what they outwardly professed is not what they were inwardly committing to. And the issue Jesus is talking about is being someone who's consistent through and through. Because integrity is the exact opposite of hypocrisy. And Job exemplified integrity. I want you to notice in Job chapter 2 and verse 3, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." You probably remember the story that in one day he lost everything. Children, livestock, wealth, homes, health. Everything has come against him except for the taking of his own life. But God looked down on Job, and despite all the suffering Job was going through, Job still had his integrity. He hadn't sacrificed his credibility yet, his credibility to man or to God for that matter. And then in Job chapter 2 and verse 9, his wife, Job's wife comes to him and says, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." Job is being challenged by his wife to give up being honest, to give up being credible, to give up his integrity, and to just turn on God. And Job didn't. In Job chapter 27 and verse 5, he said, "Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me." Job intended to hold on to his integrity, despite what he faced. But why is integrity so important? As we bring this to a close, because God epitomized integrity. Now, we don't see the word integrity appear much throughout Scripture, but the word we do see in association with God is holy. It's the same thing. Holy means righteous through and through. And in 1 Peter chapter 1, we're called as obedient children to not be conformed to the passions of our former ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. In other words, we're to pursue integrity, to maintain our integrity. We're to pursue being people of integrity because God was. On top of that, by being a person of integrity, you might lead others to glorify God. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, Peter says, "I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul, and keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify your God on the day he visits us." That if we maintain our integrity, our credibility, we might lead other people to glorify God because they look at us and they see that consistency of integrity. And the other thing about integrity that it does is it deflects accusations. No one can accuse you if you're a person of integrity. Or let me rephrase that. No accusation can stick if you're a person of integrity. 1 Peter chapter 3 tells us to set in our hearts to honor Christ the Lord as holy, to always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, but to do it with gentleness and respect. And it concludes with this: having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. Because their accusations don't stick when you're a person of integrity. Integrity matters. And what Jesus is calling for as he denounces oaths here isn't to keep us from utilizing oaths, but to keep us from needing to utilize oaths. Because if we're people of integrity, our word is as good as gold. Our yes will be yes, and our no will be no. For me, that's the big deal about oaths. That's the point Jesus was making. And I hope tonight that has helped you come to a better understanding of this passage as well.
This message has been brought to you by the Scenic Hills Church of Christ in Pensacola, Florida. For questions, comments, prayers, or Bible study, please call, mail, or email us. or visit us on the internet at scenichillschurchofchrist.org. God bless.